Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Acclaimed novelist David Gates has a new collection of stories and a novella. A Hand Reached Down to Guide Me includes 11 stories and the novella Banishment. The collection is his first in 15 years. David Gates was anointed by New York Magazine as, quote, a true heir to both Raymond Carver and John Cheever. He's also the author of the Pulitzer Prize finalist Jernigan and the novel Preston Falls. He teaches at the University of Montana and is also associated with the Bennington Writing Seminars in Bennington, Vermont. It is a great pleasure to welcome David Gates to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
A great pleasure to have you on the program. What is it like to put together a collection, especially after it's been a while?
Long. Very long. It's fun, actually, putting together a collection and figuring out what kind of sequence you want to put these things in, figuring out how to separate the ones that are similar and keep them at a fairly good distance in the book. You want to go boy, girl, if you possibly can, because I've got both male and female protagonists.
Do you write with the thoughts that, okay, this will eventually be a collection, or does that really not enter into your thoughts until they have collected?
No, I certainly don't think about it until, of course, I'm looking forward to that, but I certainly don't write things knowing that they're going to be part of some big thing. With the exception of the novella, which my editor wanted me to add. This was originally just going to be 10 stories, and he thought, well, you know, there's room for a couple more, or maybe a novella. So I took him up on that.
And you start off with that, right?
I did, yeah.
And does that, do you think that sets the tone in a way?
I have no idea. I don't know what the tone is. It's a pretty nasty tone.
Well, I guess that's why I'm asking you to, well, you start off with that.
Well, you can't put it in the middle, so right. You're either going to put it at the beginning or you're going to put it last. And I wanted to put the title story last because because I'm kind of in love with the last line. I'll read you the last line.
Please do.
This is such a cheesy move that I just had to do it. So here's the last line of the last story in the book. But I can't begin to tell you. Now, how meta is that? Huh?
Yeah.
So that had to come last, right? And also, it's the title story. So the only other place to put the novella was at the beginning.
The title story being A Hand Reached Down to Guide Me. How, in relation to the other stories, how old is that in the chronology?
That's one of the later ones. Mm-hmm. I would say that came out in Granta magazine last winter.
So what makes it the title story? Do you even know that at the time, or is it through the culling process that you say,
It's through the culling process. I'm terrible at titles. It takes me forever to think of them. And when I get a good one, I'm liable to stick to it and ride it. And I think it's the best title in the whole collection.
It is a great title.
It's a wonderful title. It comes from a Stanley Brothers song called My Sinful Past.
Hmm. Are you often encouraged or inspired by music?
I certainly listen to a lot of music. I have to control myself a little bit when I'm putting in little allusions to songs in stories and novels, because I can just go overboard on it. I can talk about music and listen to music for hours and hours and hours, and it gets very inside baseball after a while. But nevertheless, I keep doing it.
You were going to read from the beginning of a story in a moment, and as you were going through the book and identifying what you were going to read for us, you came upon one part and you said, oh, well, maybe that's too obscure. Do you worry about that in collecting sometimes that things become more for you than they are, perhaps for the reader, that they are obscure?
Only on the radio.
Okay. Yeah.
No. Yes and no. If I really, really love something and it's still completely obscure, it's going to go in. If it's just something that's obscure and also self-indulgent, then it's going to go.
Hmm.
But I trust readers to be with me if I'm, you know, they'll meet me halfway, I think, if I'll meet them halfway.
Well, just the idea of you writing and us reading is sort of self-indulgent, right?
Of course.
Right.
What else are we both here for? Not to indulge.
Kind of the whole point of it.
I know.
So tell us a story that you're going to read us a bit from.
This is a story, speaking of titles I'm not so happy with, it's a story called An Actor Prepares, which, of course, is the title of the Stanislavski book. And I was stuck for a title, so finally I thought I would put that one on it. It is about an actor who goes up to, he's a very unsuccessful actor. He's doing some radio commercials and he's not getting much work. And an old friend of his who's rather more successful invites him up to the Northeast Kingdom in Vermont to do a summer production of Twelfth Night. So this is just the first paragraph of his little first-person narration. Last summer, on a plane back from Frankfurt, I happened to look up at an overhead screen while trying to learn my lines in Twelfth Night. And for a second, I thought I saw myself in a promotional video for Singapore Airlines among a crowd at JFK 2 weeks earlier. They couldn't possibly have produced this so fast, could they? But there was the distressed leather jacket, the mirrored sunglasses, the gray hair, silver, let's call it, and the profile. Ah, still a handsome devil. I'd been going to see a 28-year-old German woman I'd met in New York, who said if I came over, she'd figure out something to tell her boyfriend. Just this afternoon, I told an old friend, someone I've known for years at any rate, that this was the moment I knew I had to quit acting. I'd studied myself on tape however many hundreds of times, and never had I been so convincing. Who wouldn't cast this guy as the old lech on his last go-round?
That is from An Actor Prepares, a story in the collection A Hand Reached Down to Guide Me, Stories and a Novella by David Gates, published by Knopf. You, in reading these, and I read this in one or two reviews of your work, and it kind of struck me that often in your writing that you don't seem to be necessarily in a hurry to get to a particular destination.
You mean there's no plot? This is what you're telling me, Joe.
No, I don't think that's the case at all. That you allow us to enjoy your craft as the writer, but also to let those characters live and breathe for a while before they do what they're going to do.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think I want you to get to know them a little bit before they do the awful or sometimes the less awful things that they do.
And is that a way, and I don't want to reduce it in any way, but is that a way of playing with the characters, of allowing them to, for you as a writer, to just, okay, see what they're about?
Yeah, exactly. I get to know them by writing them. They don't exist in my head ahead of time. I just begin to write about them, and then they reveal themselves to me in what they do and what they say and what they think and what they do for a living. And, you know, I discover them in the process of writing sentences about them, and eventually they become clear to me, and then they can get busy.
When you say what they do for a living, the list of professions is quite long and very eclectic. It can be anything from a pilot to a doctor to a professor, journalists, academics, directors, composers, many artistic pursuits.
Yeah, I'm glad you think that because I secretly think they're all writers. So I stick the architect label on one and the contractor label on another and the actor label on another. I've got a composer. I can't write about writers all the time.
So what makes them writers in your mind?
Well, in some sense, they reflect aspects of me. And writing is the thing I know most about. And a lot of my friends are writers. So, of course, it's boring to write about writers. So then you want to move people with some kind of a writerly or artistic sensibility a little place over to the side. So what's it like to be a composer? What's it like to be an actor? I have no idea.
Mm. To me, I guess, and that's almost code for being thoughtful and analytical.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right.
That you want to think things through.
Or I want them to be thinking things through. I want these to be the kind of, you know, they're all Prince Hamlet, for God's sake. That's what they are.
or
Princess Hamlet in the case of the novella.
Tell us about the novella. How did the novella come about?
As I'd said, my editor had wanted this book to be a little bit longer. He would have been happy to have had 10 stories. But then he worked on my better nature, I think. And since he wanted maybe 2 more stories or a novella, I thought it'd be easier to make one start rather than 2. And I'd never written it that length, and the idea of that intrigued me also.
Because when you originally told that story at the beginning of our conversation, I thought that the novella had been around and it was something that you were going to include. So you wrote it especially for the collection.
I wrote it especially for the book. And then when that was done, I added one more story. I just suddenly struck gold and wrote a story called Locals that crept into the book quite late.
What is it about writing a novella that is different than writing a novel that is different than writing a short story?
The obvious thing is the length.
Yeah.
You can actually get a novella done in your lifetime as opposed to a novel. And it also lets you stretch out a little, lets you make a few more things happen, lets you introduce maybe some more characters. You don't feel quite as fenced in when you're doing that. I say this as someone who, I sound like I've written 50 novellas. This is the only one. But I like it. I'd love to write more of them.
Do you understand why that often an audience is more interested in a novel than they are a novella or a collection of stories even?
I think I do. I think, actually, I had a conversation about this a couple of days ago with a friend. I think people like an immersive experience. They like to sink into a book. And fool that I was, I thought, of course, the internet and, you know, the relatively fast pace of life would make the short story or the novella an ideal literary form. In fact, it seems to be turning out to be just the opposite. People want something that's an escape. They want something that's, take them a week or two to read.
In the novels that you have written, and as you said, you know, something that you can complete in your lifetime, do you know why it takes you so long?
I don't. I know why it takes me so long. I don't know why in a couple of cases, like with this novella and with the last story I wrote, it takes me such a short time to do it. I'm one of these people who goes over sentence by sentence, rewrites and rewrites and rewrites. But, I'm also an old journalist. I was on Weekly Deadline for Newsweek for years and years. And deadlines are wonderful. When you've got to get something done by a certain time, you will get it done by a certain time. and I had a deadline looming over me for this collection, had to do it or felt I had to do it, and did it.
You write a lot about the Northeast.
I do.
And which is an area that you live part-time in. What is it about that makes it of interest to you?
In part, it's really because it's the only place I know. I grew up in Connecticut. I lived in, I've had a house in Granville, New York for many years, since 1985. I lived for a couple of years in Virginia, but aside from that, it's all been the Northeast. It's been Connecticut, New York State, New York City. So I don't know any place else, and I'm very attached to it, very fond of it. And, you don't think of Northeastern writers as regional writers, but really that's what I am.
Mm. You have a connection to Montana. Have you been inspired to write about that place?
I don't know enough about Montana to write about it. I've been there for 4 years. There are people there who have been there all their lives or have been there for 20, 25 years, and they really get the place. I love it. I love living there, but I don't really have the chutzpah to start to write Montana stories. That just would be arrogant, I think.
It's interesting that you find that would be arrogant to me, because there's also that outsider approach. Mm-hmm. I'm coming into a foreign place, and I'm going to write what my interpretation of it is.
Yeah, and I've seen writers do that, and I almost never like it. Suddenly, John Cheever, who's one of my favorite writers, at some point, obviously, he went to Italy.
Right.
And, not as good as Shady Hill. Or Dickens, who, when he had the money to travel to Europe, suddenly he's setting the beginning of Little Dorrit in Marseille, and he doesn't know Marseille the way he knows London. He doesn't know Switzerland the way he knows London or Venice. He's, of course, interested. He's a good reporter. Or the United States in Martin Chuzzlewit. Dreadful section of a wonderful book.
How long did it take before you felt that you knew Granville?
Oh, I think I thought I knew it before I really knew much of anything about it, but it felt like home to me. It was like the town that I grew up in Connecticut back when I was growing up, so it felt like home.
And I guess there's still that Northeast, especially Northern New York, ideal to it and to that whole region.
Yeah. Actually, I'd always wanted to live in Vermont, and I moved across the state line. Granville's not very far, because I found a place I could afford better than I could afford Vermont. So in a way, it's nice to write about Vermont from across the border. I idealize Vermont perhaps more than I should, but it's fun to idealize it.
It strikes me, and without getting too in the weeds here, because I know the town that you live in. So it fascinates me, though, because you are just a mile from the border, and yet crossing that border, there is a difference.
Well, there's a huge, you can tell it. You can tell it in the buildings. You can tell it in the landscape. A mile from Vermont is just the story of my life. When I was a little kid, my parents had an old farmhouse in Rowe, Massachusetts, which is where that Yankee Atomic plant was. And in fact, we had to sell that place when they built the plant. And that you could walk into Vermont from that house. You can practically walk into Vermont from my house in Granville. So I'm circling it. But I'm never going to get there.
Do you think it would change if you were there?
Oh, yeah, and for the worse. I'd just be disillusioned.
What do you think there is about that place, and maybe even about New England, that is often idealized?
Well, physically, it's beautiful, and architecturally, it's beautiful. And there's such a rich and grim history there. The whole, you know, from the Pilgrims coming over and the Puritans coming over slightly later, the City on the Hill speech, the Transcendentalists around Concord, wonderful both intellectual and political history there. And there's an equally rich history in Virginia. There's an equally rich history in California and Texas. But this is that New England history is the one that I know and grew up with and respond to.
And yet where you live, there is a slate industry,
a
quarry. And you could, in some cases, I've been told, be writing about Pittsburgh or West Virginia.
Yeah, probably more like West Virginia than than like Pittsburgh. But I don't think we get black lung in Granville. I hope we don't. And the slate quarrying business doesn't seem to be as filthy, a polluting business.
Right.
Doesn't seem to be spewing CO2 into the air.
But the hardworking men and women.
And also the immigrant men and women. It's not as waspy as, you know, much of early New England has been. There are people there from Italy and Wales. There's still a significant Welsh presence there.
So without being overly psychological, it seems as though much of the writing then, if often these characters are writers in a guise, that it's how the writers often will communicate with the locals, with those people.
There's always a distance. I could live in Granville for 50 years and not really be a local person,
right,
as much as I, you know, would like to do that. I'm certainly an outsider. It's someone who drives to New York every week when I'm living there, pretty much. And people there don't do that. It's not that long a drive. It's 4 hours. But people, for some reason, don't do it. I do it a fair amount.
Is there a necessity? Do you think there's a necessity for you as a writer to do that?
To go back and forth?
Hmm.
Yeah, there's a necessity for me, I think, to be in both places. But given my druthers, I think I'd be in the country.
Hmm.
Fortunately, I'm not forced to have my druthers.
When you're in Montana, is there a place that you can go that is similar?
Not within a day's drive. Well, you can make it to Seattle in a day's drive. But Missoula is a university town. It's got lots of restaurants and bars and people and a couple of good bookstores. I don't really need much more than that. I don't need a subway.
What is there about teaching writing that informs you?
I like passing along the stuff that people have taught me. I've had the privilege of working with really, really good editors who really changed my life and my approach to writing. And I'd love to pass that on to other people. Also, if you're teaching young writers, your students are always the same age every year. And you feel that you're also the same age, which of course isn't true, but it's a wonderful thing to think. And it's also it's very heartening to keep meeting young people who still want to be doing this. There's not always much money in it. It's harder than it was, I think, to make a living. Teaching jobs are harder to get. But still, year after year after year, here are these people who want to be writers, who read the same people that I read, who think the same way about writing that I do. It's a wonderful thing.
The new book is A Hand Reached Down to Guide Me, Stories and a Novella. It is published by Knopf. David Gates, thank you so much for being with us this week. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, and a great pleasure to be here, too.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, A Hand Reached Down to Guide Me, Stories and a Novella by David Gates. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.